It's Wednesday, April 10th, 2024, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and I'm joined by my two colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, why Republican lawmakers had a sheriff's deputy remove a reporter from public land in the state of Colorado. It was a twice-in-a-lifetime event, another total eclipse. We weren't in the path of totality this time, but it was still pretty cool. And
perfection with a touch of sweet redemption. Undefeated South Carolina has won its third national championship.
March Madness has come to an end. Was this the year that the women's tournament eclipsed the men's? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll talk to before our half hour is up today, but we're going to start with changes to the Facebook algorithm and how we're seeing them play out, because our lead story this week is one of those. And it's one of those kind of questions you would ask. Is it a change to the algorithm or his censorship at play here? The Kansas Reflector, it's a sister publication to the Missouri Independent. It published a column last week about how there was an attempt to share and boost a post about a documentary that focused on local efforts to fight climate change. Facebook rejected that request to boost or to pay for extra exposure on the part of the Kansas Reflector, stating that the request and that the URL violated community standards. Now, Facebook has responded to the Reflector and claiming that the rejection was actually a rejection of the domain of the URL address itself. But two other reposts of that column also got blocked.
Yeah, this is, we've talked so much on this show about these platforms like Facebook that do not want to take responsibility for being publishers, and they are publishers. And so if you see yourself as a publisher, you are going to set certain standards for what you will publish, you will be transparent about those standards, and you will stick to those standards. Facebook has never acknowledged that it's a publisher. So it is trying to straddle this very awkward tightrope, if that's not a mixed metaphor, where they're trying to say that they have these standards, and but they keep moving all the time. And so I think we've talked about this on this show, one of the problems is if you're a publisher, a real publisher who acknowledges that you're a publisher, like the Kansas Reflector, and you depend on Facebook or any social media for your distribution, you really have an unreliable distribution service because you can't count on them. And I think it's just so important for news organizations, legitimate news organizations that own the fact that they're publishers, to somehow create their own means of distribution. We used to own the means of distribution, we don't anymore, and maybe it's time somehow we take it back.
Well, that's where the problem's going to come. How are you going to do that? I mean, it's almost like what you're saying is that the Kansas Reflector, Missouri Independent, all these others, they're going to have to create their own programs. And then how do you get that program out to a large enough audience to be able to then bring in revenue to keep yourself afloat?
Yeah, and the other program is called subscriptions.
Yeah, well, that's
newsletters,
right.
You know,
yeah,
so
right.
There are other ways around it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are other ways around it, but the problem with that is that's not generally the way in which people get their news and information, and we've had that conversation over and over again, too. So that's the problem, is that you've got Facebook, you've got Google, you've got X, formerly known as Twitter. They own the distribution model, and now you're having to somehow negotiate with them as to how you're going to distribute your content, but then they control whether or not they can pull the plug
on. And they're constantly moving the bar, right?
Exactly.
So this documentary that the Kansas Reflector wanted to promote and encourage attendance at a screening, the name of the documentary is Hot Times in the Heartland. So what are the chances if you can let your mind go to all of the different places that the name of a title when entered, Hot Times in the Heartland, what are the chances that it was an automated system that automatically rejected that as opposed to human eyes that would be looking at evaluating the legitimacy and accepting those advertising dollars?
I mean, it could be that there was an algorithm that sort of booted that out. Now, the question becomes, who set the algorithm? That was a human. And why did the committee or the individual set that algorithm in a way that would boot that out and not others? I mean,
this gets back to human greed, right? It's human greed because, you know, okay, Hot Times in the Heartland, somebody might have thought it was a porno film, right?
Yeah.
Okay, a stupid robot might have thought that. If you had human editors involved in the process, they would look at the trailer of Hot Times in the Heartland. They might even take the time to watch Hot Times in the Heartland.
Or maybe if they didn't do that, at least pick up the phone and call the person trying to place the ad or the boosted post.
But it's so much cheaper to use an algorithm or a machine, which is what an algorithm is, essentially, because algorithms don't need health insurance. Okay, and this is the problem, that when we try to automate intelligence, it doesn't always work.
Yeah, especially if the algorithm was created by someone who won't take into, okay, look past the name.
There's such a thing as a pun.
Right.
Or
right,
wordplay.
Right, no, absolutely.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
Algorithms don't get it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the things, too. I actually have it on a slide when we teach search engine optimization, as we talk about Google and the control that Google search has in terms of generating traffic to our websites, exposure for our content. Those computers don't understand puns, don't write catchy headlines.
Right, exactly. It's like Google wants you to be boring and literal.
Yes.
Right.
Be as literal as you can. So in Colorado, there, a well-respected veteran reporter found herself on the outs, quite literally. In the wee hours of Saturday morning, Sandra Fish got a text message from a Republican Party event organizer telling her that she was no longer permitted to attend the GOP's assembly to be held that day on Saturday at the state fairgrounds. She went anyway, checking in at the door, and was given a press credential by somebody at that front table to enter the event. About an hour after she arrived, two sheriff's deputies approached Fish and told her she needed to leave the premises despite having that credential that is around her neck that showed she could be there. She was not welcome, and that they told her it was technically not an open press event. Now, Kathy, said the party has come out and said that they chose to close this to the press and Sandy Fish specifically because of what they had viewed as unfair coverage of them in the past. You're laughing. Tell people
I'm
why
laughing.
You've
I'm
got the giggles now.
I'm laughing because I know Fish, which is the name she likes to go by, and she is a long time, very well respected, as you said, a reporter who does a lot of data reporting and a lot of deep diving into money and politics. So I can well imagine why party officials would not appreciate her reporting. But the public appreciates her reporting. And interestingly, in some of the stories on the Links blog, you see that there are other even officials in the Republican Party, elected officials, saying this was a stupid move. Now, we had a story a couple of weeks ago that we talked about here that since then, there's been an award in that case. And that was a very similar story where a reporter, Laura Bellin, I think is how she pronounced her last name, was kicked out of the Iowa legislature. The Iowa legislature's had to pay $49,000 in a settlement to that reporter. And I think that's right. They should settle. They've had to back down. But when are people going to learn that this is, it's ridiculous behavior? I mean, and it was at a public, it's at a taxpayer-funded, the county fairgrounds venue. How do you say you can keep somebody out of that?
Well, I mean, I think what, you shouldn't be able to, and I think the settlements have to be larger. The penalties have to be larger, especially if you're at a at the public fair. I mean, you're at the state fair, which is a public event, and if you want to have your meeting, private meeting somewhere.
Hold it on private property.
Hold it on private property.
Exactly. Rent a room at the country club.
There's got to be a country club or a hotel or some other place to be able to have that meeting. There's a convention center large enough to accommodate
it. I mean, you have the right to do that in a private setting. But you're having a private meeting in a public
state fairgrounds.
Yeah. And that's the one issue I have. The other is if you're a political party, a public political party that is asking the public to support you, but you're going to prohibit someone who's trying to act in the public interest from providing news and information that the public needs to know to determine whether or not they should engage with you. That I have a problem with, because now you're limiting it. And ultimately, only the people who are within that sphere are going to engage with you.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Ernest. These political parties are quasi-public entities, really. They get a lot of support from the government. Their conventions are funded partly by the taxpayers. And, you know, okay, it's we're all interested in who we want to elect, but I think the price for that is scrutiny. There has to be scrutiny of that. The other thing I want to say, you said the fines have to be higher. Mm. Maybe there needs to be some personal responsibility too, because the problem is that $49K is going to be paid by the Iowa taxpayers, just like Josh Hawley's fine, that he was fined for holding back information and not complying with the Sunshine Request when he was Attorney General. He was fined for that, but he doesn't pay it.
Right.
The taxpayers pay it.
You know, the other thing, too, in this one that concerns me, and you see this over and over again, these private entities are using public law enforcement.
Yes, it was the sheriff who escorted her.
Yeah, to actually do their bidding. That I have a problem with. When is a police chief or a sheriff going to go like, you know what? If you don't want this individual there, then you need to hire private security and have them deal with it. Don't call us.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Fish did leave the premises. People might be confused. Why not put up a bigger fight to stay at that point?
Well,
why not kind of raise these points that we're talking about here?
Well, I think she could have. I think, like any good reporter, she probably had a PR instinct going there. And, you know, she was told she wasn't allowed to be there. I think it's actually better to make a statement by saying, okay, I'm going to respect this, but I'm going to go out and publicize it. That is our tool as journalists. We have the megaphone and use it.
Well, and by Sunday morning, the Journalism and Women Symposium, that's how I first learned about this, was an email statement issued by that group, journalists across the country, even as you said, some of the Republicans within the Colorado Party speaking out.
Well, I think, you know, part of it, too, the reason why she may not have done it is because she didn't want to be the story. She didn't want the story to be about her. She wanted it to be about the actions.
And the access.
And the access. And that's what happened when, you know, when everyone found out what they had done, then that became the story and not the reporter herself.
Okay. Kathy, I saw some of your photos on Facebook on Monday out on the quad, people collecting and watching collecting on the quad, watching the eclipse together. This creation of a shared experience and, you know, watching on TV, you could see what it was like from Mazatlan in Mexico to Burlington, Vermont, as the sun went behind the moon. We didn't experience totality here in mid-Missouri like we did back in 2017, but it was still a lot of fun being outside on Monday. I don't know, based on where you were, did you get to see any of the coverage on Monday of what was going on either on local TV? I know KMIZ did a 3-hour special here, or on national television.
No, I saw some of the coverage afterwards. Yeah. I didn't see the coverage during. I was out, you know, I was out on the
you
quad
were
with
the
everybody.
Okay.
Everybody else watching.
I worked for home on Monday.
Watching the at least the partial. What we get 95-96% here.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how sunny it still is with only 94% coverage. You know, it's amazing.
But I mean, the thing that really, that really caught my attention was the fact that this was an event that brought people together in a way that basically we haven't seen in a long time.
Yes.
I mean, there's been so much division and so much, you know, angst.
It only takes
on.
A celestial phenomenon.
It takes
across America to come together.
Exactly. And so, I mean, and I talked to people out on the quad and then afterwards about that, and they all sort of shook their head and were like, you know, yeah, this is, you know, we all came together. No one was fighting or arguing or came up with some sort of conspiracy theory, at least not those who are those around, came with some sort of conspiracy theory about
the
what was happening at the time.
Trying to figure
right.
Out.
But it was, and that's the thing that I enjoyed the most about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, as you said, Amy, we did not experience totality, but we experienced community.
Yeah,
and I think that was really important. And I was, I have a class that I teach Monday afternoons. And so the week before, we were talking about the eclipse, and I said to the students, of course, you'll miss it because you'll be here in class. And they kind of looked at me, and I said, April Fool.
Well, and two of your students were in my office for a good hour yesterday talking to me about what they got to do and how they got to go cover it. Now, they experienced this idea of a large-scale, dare I say global, but not really, news event that they got to cover. And at the same time, they still got to participate and engage in it. Like during what would have been totality in other places, they put their camera down and they looked up at the sky and they got to both experience it as a journalist and as, you know, regular.
As a human being.
Human being.
Yeah, exactly. Journalists are humans too. But I think, one of the students, when we all came back into class after it was over, and I was asking the students about their experience, one young man said exactly what Ernest did. He said, you know, there are so many things that divide us, and this brought us together. And, you know, maybe that's what celestial events are supposed to be for, to remind us that we're all little people on this tiny little blue dot, and we better start rowing in the same direction. It really is amazing. I thought on the coverage, the most spectacular thing I saw was the New York Times the next day online ran this graphic of, it was a video shot from space, from satellites, where you actually saw the shadow of the moon passing across the continent. I really recommend people go look that up because it is amazing. And I think, again, you know, we're all on USS or SS Earth, and it gives you that sense of our shared humanity.
Yeah. Well, one of the points I wanted to make too, and I guess I'll make this as the one person who worked from home. So half the time I was in front of a TV. For about 45 minutes, I was outside just kind of looking up. This was one of those instances where TV news was able to do the thing in real time. And I appreciate what you're saying about the New York Times. At the same time, this was one of those, and we experienced it the same way in 2017, that by, 3:15, 3:30, life went back to normal and nobody cared anymore.
Yeah.
That by watching it live as it was unfolding, by seeing people's reactions, be it the journalists, be it the people who had traveled from across the country to the areas of totality, it created that shared experience over space and time that we had in that moment without just the people next to us. And there was part of me that kind of wondered, like, by the next day, how much interest is there in something like that, that what you're describing on the New York Times website, or have we moved on? Like, it's over, come back in 2044.
I mean, I think there was some of that, but there are also people who, before, you know, we got to at least the part of it that we could see here in Missouri, that were talking about, okay, so when is the next one? And am I going to be around for the next one? And
some of my neighbors were talking about that with me, just like that.
And it's almost like you're going like, oh, I want to do this again. Uh-huh. Am I going to be around for that? And that I thought was some interesting conversation, especially with when you have those of us who are older talking to those of us who are younger, and you're thinking, hey, they're going to be around for the next one. I'm not sure whether or not I will be.
And that's an important part of the human vulnerability that whole event brought up to. And I think that puts things in perspective in a way that our ordinary everyday life doesn't.
I saw a great political cartoon that's been floating around the past couple of days. Two basketballs, one eclipsing the other, each representing another of the NCAA basketball tournaments, the men's and the women's. And this year, it really did feel like it. Like the women's tournament eclipsed the men's. That the buzz, it made it so big. And we're hearing early today that the ratings from Sunday's championship, which came in as the highest rated basketball game, men's or women's, in the last 5 years, did actually draw a bigger audience than the UConn-Purdue men's game Monday evening. Take a listen here to what South Carolina head coach Dawn Staley had to say minutes after winning that third NCAA championship.
And I want to personally thank Caitlin Clark for lifting up our sport. She carried a heavy load for our sport, and it just is not going to stop here on the collegiate tour. But when she is the number one pick in the WNBA draft, she's gonna lift that league up as well. So Caitlin Clark, if you're out there, you are one of the GOATs of our games. And we appreciate you.
So, you know, it was, 2021? So 2-3 years ago, we're talking about how the women's NCAA tournament, there was substandard locker rooms. It was questions of quite literally like Title IX type stuff. What's going on in the men's tournament and the women's tournament? Where and how did that shift come to be so quickly? Is that the Caitlin Clark effect, or is it something more?
I think Caitlin Clark had a lot to do with it, yeah, especially both last year and this year. But I also think that there was this push after that by women, both coaches as well as those involved behind the scenes, the directors and player personnel, that sort of thing, and the players themselves that said, wait a minute, you know, we're putting in just as much effort as the men, and we deserve to have this. So I think that was the other thing. The one key thing I think you saw this season, mm-hmm, especially around the tournament, but even leading into the tournament, was that you had more personalities in the women's game. You had Caitlin Clark, of course. You had Angel Reese. You had Juju, who's playing out on the West Coast. You had Buckers, I think that was her name, who was at UConn. You have women personalities, and that you didn't have in the men's because of the transfer rules, because of NIL,
That's
the one and done. That's the difference between the men's game and the women's game. And people are drawn to personalities, especially in television. You can't script this any better. Mm-hmm. And that's what you had in this year's women's basketball, the season as a whole, the tournament in particular, that you didn't have in the men's.
Yeah, I think I absolutely agree with everything you said. I think, of course, having a superstar, like, you know, everybody was likening this to the era of Larry Bird and Michael Jordan.
Right.
And that definitely is going to draw eyeballs. But I think a lot of it is a building thing. You know, we have to look back to Mia Hamm and the women's soccer, mm-hmm, team. And
Dawn Staley herself,
exactly,
being on the women's basketball, right, team in 1996 that won the first gold medal.
Right.
Yeah, and so I think there's been a build towards this. I think we've recently had the 50th anniversary of Title IX, and that caused a lot of people to reflect, how far have we come? Have we come far enough? So I think this has been a building thing, but certainly having a superstar on the court was a catalyst. And as Ernest said, you can't, you know, I think that's a great point about the way the transfer portal, mm-hmm, has changed things, because you still hear people talking about the, you know, everybody will always associate Michael Jordan with North Carolina, right? Everybody will associate Larry Bird with Indiana. That's not necessarily going to be true in the era of the transfer portal for,
right,
And
I think the other thing, too, that you have this year is that in the women's game, there's stability.
Mm-hmm.
in the men's game,
exactly.
Whether you're talking about basketball, you're talking about football.
It's one and done, and you barely get to know a player before they've entered the...
But even more so than that, there's so much instability right now. You've got... I mean, I was listening on
the
way in.
You don't know who to root for. Who's on your team?
Exactly. You've got the West Coast teams playing in East Coast conferences next year. It is going to be a free-for-all. On the men's side, everyone trying to figure out, who am I rooting for? Where am I going to go to a game? What is it going to look like? Whereas on the women's side, their stability, their personalities, and there is a definite marketable product there.
Dawn Staley also made some news last week with an answer to a question that was posed of her during one of the off-day news conferences. She was asked if anybody who identifies as a woman should be allowed to play on a woman's team. She said yes. This question was asked by a reporter from an outlet called Outkick. This reporter has gotten a lot of backlash himself. Where and how does Outkick fall into the journalism ecosystem?
I think it falls into that journalism ecosystem, the way in which most, we say, publications that are not part of the mainstream.
Okay.
Historically, we've had those publications. I mean, they've either been advocacy publications or dissident publications, and sometimes they're brought into the mainstream, and sometimes those publications stay on the outside, and they ask those difficult questions, and they put those stories out there as a way to get people to think about, hey, there's another side to this.
And so he caught a lot of heat for asking it in that setting on that day, and his whole thing is, well, why not? But people were saying it was too political, didn't have a place there, shouldn't have been asked. Thoughts on that?
Since when as reporters, as journalists, do we censor ourselves? And we're not in the business to be popular. We are in the business to ask questions that people have on their minds, and to ask them. And you seize the opportunity to ask a question. It's hard to get a major league coach in front of you. It's very difficult. You can't. So I think this whole idea of we're not sitting down to have tea with somebody's mother-in-law. You know, we're there to do a job.
Okay. Before we go, we've got about a minute and a half left, and I have one of those temperature-taking type questions to talk to you about. This one has to do with our uneasy relationships with digital devices, namely our cell phones. We have our phones nearby, all wearing watches connected to our phones. Maybe a week or two from now, we'll have different answers about just how close they are to us. And that could be because you'll end up following my lead and taking The Guardian up on a call to action it's issued in the last week or so. Sign up to Reclaim Your Brain. Reclaim Your Brain is a 5-week email newsletter from The Guardian science journalist that promises to coach readers to reset screen habits using evidence-based tasks to help readers create better boundaries with phones and relationships with technology. I'm kind of excited to see this approach to service journalism in a bit of a different way.
Well, this gets to what we were talking about earlier. I mean, part of getting around some of the internet platforms who aren't so helpful is educating our audience about how to interact with technology. And I think this is it's not only a good service on the part of The Guardian, it's also strategic, it's smart. Because I think if we as news providers can help reset that relationship, we benefit in the long run.
Okay, we are pretty much out of time for this week. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about all of the topics we talked about on our links blog under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is at @ViewsOnKBIA. We're going to be audio only next week, so if you're watching us on Facebook, you're going to have to check kbia.org.